This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to part two of the Giant Size Hard Traveling Fanboys podcast. If you listened to part one, which I hope you did, it's on the site, placetobenation.com. Click on it. You know that we went all over the place. We as we often do, we veered all around the racetrack and ended up back at the 90s, which was the, I guess, height or low point, if you will, depending on your viewpoint, of the crossover age, the event book age. And we talked about some stories in part one, such as Nightfall and the death of Superman, that I think the panel would mostly agree age pretty well. And we also talked about some events, like the Clone Saga, that have not aged particularly well. One event that we did not talk about was DC's first big event book of the 90s, which was Armageddon 2001, which was it did a couple of things. It introduced the character of Wave Rider, who I liked as a kid. I thought he was kind of decent. He had an interesting design to him, and a time traveler character. But it was basically a time travel amalgamation kind of story that involved a lot of, it tied into a lot of the annuals for the characters and gave us alternate futures. We talked in a recent podcast about an issue of Action Comics, I believe, that was an Action Comics annual that or a Superman annual that had a sort of dystopian take on Superman that inverted the Dark Knight Returns. But there were also a lot of tie-ins to this event. And the issue with Armageddon 2001 is the entire premise was that the bad guy, the mysterious bad guy, was going to be a
Monarch.
Hero. Monarch, who was going to be a hero who at some point had broken bad, so to speak. And it was originally going to be Captain Atom. And all the hints leading up to it were for Captain Atom. The story was actually pretty good. It was a pretty good event for a while. And at some point, in the fledgling days of news groups, the internet, and just comic fandom, this was pre-internet explosion, but there were news groups at the time. People started getting word, I guess, some people, pockets of people, were getting word that Captain Atom was going to go rogue and be the new big bad in the DC universe. Well, someone at DC Editorial, midway through this event, hears that some out there in the comic book community, which at this time literally numbers in the hundreds of thousands, and you're talking about a small pocket of maybe 500 to 1,000 people that have gotten out that this is going to happen. And whoever it is that makes this decision figures, okay, well, we can't have it be Captain Atom. It's time to shake things up a bit. And so, in classic Vince McMahon fashion, they give us a swerve in which the big villain is revealed to not be Captain Atom, but to be the character Hawk from Hawk and Dove, which A, is anticlimactic, and B, made absolutely no sense in the context of the greater story.
Given that in the story it had already been established at that point that the villain Monarch had killed Hawk in combat earlier. So Hawk killed himself and yet became the thing that killed him. Like, it was a
really... Not just that. Future Hawk killed past Hawk, which somehow didn't erase him from existence.
Yes.
Which made you think, if this can happen, then you've just invalidated your entire premise, so why should we care about any of these proceedings?
Exactly. Yep. And Greg, like you said, what makes it especially frustrating is, like you said, it really was an interesting, fairly well-crafted story up to the point when it came time for the reveal. The problem with the swerve on the reveal isn't that it was a swerve for swerve's sake, but rather this. You know, and granted, when I read it with the benefit of hindsight and knowing what to, you know, hints to look for and things, but even when I read it, the problem was it seemed like they were hinting at it being Captain Atom all along. And if you're going to drop hints and breadcrumbs along the trail, why are you going to get so pissed off and so anxious and veer so far off course when people put the pieces together that you've already been sowing in the first place. If your idea is to shock everyone, then don't drop hints. But, like, if you're going to drop hints, don't be angry at your readership for being, you know, not complete idiots and smart enough to figure it out on their own, is my
For the wrestling fans out there, it was the equivalent of Matt Hardy turning heel on his brother to help Edge at the Royal Rumble whenever that year was. Nonsensical because people had figured out that it was going to be Christian. But, Russell, you were about to say something?
Oh, I was just, thinking that I was agreeing with you that Armageddon 2001, it starts off so great, and then it trails into a terrible reveal there at the end. But, I mean, in this day and age of, you know, how information and news comes out and is actually put out by the comic book publishers themselves, everybody almost knows how stories end long before we ever get to them. And, you know, it's, I don't want to say that they've gotten completely over that, but maybe they've tried to subvert it in a way. And now it's almost expected that we're going to know how these stories end long before we get there anyway.
And exactly. Yeah, it's one of those things where just because a story is predictable doesn't mean it's bad or that it's the wrong story to tell.
Exactly.
I mean, Nick said, they dropped these threads and they made these hints that, you know, the logical deduction is that it's Captain Atom. And that's the conclusion that very astute fans arrived at, and that was the right outcome of the story that they were trying to tell. It's one of these things where, you know, 20 years, 10 years, even 5 or 1 year after the fact, does anyone give a shit that you figured out what the big twist was? Exactly. No, of course not. It's, you know, if you want your story to hold up and to be timeless and to be a classic, then you don't change it on the fly because people guess what your big twist is at the time.
I'll give you an example. Every time I read Watchmen now, I know that Ozymandias is the villain. Do I care coming in that Ozymandias is the villain? Does that make me read that story with any less, like, love and admiration than I do every time I sit down to read it? Of course not. Like, right. And another thing is, like, it's always been rumored to be a leak, but is it really a leak when you're just, like, hinting at it slowly but surely, as much as it is just an educated guess, good educated guess?
And if you're looking at a modern context, I remember Russell and I and you kind of, and Russell I think was the first, I'll give him credit, in our group to kind of predict this, saw that Necron was probably going to be the villain in Blackest Night because it made sense.
Yeah,
and it was the right move for the story.
Again, Greg, to use your wrestling reference, let's go back to the Royal Rumble a few years ago when everything made sense for Chris Jericho to win the Royal Rumble. And then, whoa, swerve, he didn't. But, you know, it's one of those things where I think comic publishers and creative teams can outthink themselves at times. Like,
definitely.
Whether the story is a surprise should always come secondary to whether the story makes logical sense, whether it has
it
an emotional
come secondary
impact.
To what's the story.
Yeah.
You know?
Russell, I think you remember what I'm talking about. Yeah.
I do, and at the time, I think there were a couple of other people who were latching on to that idea, that since it was being heavily hinted that that's where we were going before the solicit for it, the big solicit reveal ever happened. But once it did, I was like, okay, well, you know, Geoff Johns is following the line of thought or the train of thought that I was just reading along the story. So it's like, okay, well, we're just on the same wavelength. Did I think it was any great thing that I figured out that Necron was going to be the big bad of Blackest Night? No. I just figured, that's cool. I figured where he was going, and I'm glad that we're on the same page because now I feel like this story is going to be even more enjoyable to me that I was able to do that. And there are some people out there who, you know, if they figure out where a story is going, they get, I don't know, and they get, you know, really indignant about it. Almost like, oh my God, it was so predictable, and now it's going to make it terrible. And like, not really.
You kind of feel sorry for those people. I mean, like, for example, if these people had figured out that, you know, Alberto Falcone was the holiday killer, does that ruin possibly the greatest Batman story of all time for them? You know, I mean, like, right. At what point do you just kind of have to get over it? Like, you know, not everything you ever do is gonna be surprising, is what I'm saying, I guess.
Yeah, and Nick, you actually, I don't want to spoil it completely, but Nick, there was a while back you made a call about a certain book that I wasn't completely sold on, but then whenever you turned out to be right, I was like, you know what, it makes so much damn sense, and it just completely worked.
I wish I knew what book you were talking about.
Well, I don't want to spoil it in case you haven't read it. I don't know how far along you are.
In what book?
It's in DC Forever Evil.
Yeah, I'm finished. I'm finished. Yes, it made sense. Yes, it's going to be awesome. We'll get to that next year.
Yeah, well, so that's what I was figuring on. It's like I didn't necessarily see it going that direction, but whenever it did, I was like, okay, well, that's I'm glad it placed where it was.
Yeah, me too.
Well, so we're gonna put a bow on the 90s here with asking the same question that we asked for the 80s. Favorite event of the 90s,
Greg, least
favorite event. Oh, I forgot, actually.
Podcast tradition. We have to do this discussion.
We have not.
Wait just a moment, sir.
Back the train up.
That's right. We have not mentioned Fabian Nicieza, first of all. So how are you,
nope.
Fabian? We love you.
Or.
I can kill two birds with one stone, potentially, because I'm sure I'll go off on a tangent.
Or the Golgothan shit monster.
Which is exactly about to happen, because the major event that I read from start to finish. In comics, besides Onslaught, which, spoiler alert, is my least favorite event of the 90s, was the DC versus Marvel event of, I believe it was 97, 96.
96.
And in which DC and Marvel decided, hey, let's make money together, which is a fine reason to do anything, but they, under normal circumstances, but... The problem was the industry was kind of falling apart at the time a little bit, and they said, hey, let's make a bunch of money. Let's do our biggest heroes versus your biggest heroes, allegedly, and put them together and let the fans vote on who's going to win these matchups, which is not a good idea at all. Russell actually has a column up right now on placetobenation.com, where, by the way, you can catch all of our wonderful work each week. And in this article, which is again at placetobenation.com, Russell showed several of the, shall we say, unfortunate panels from the DC versus Marvel limited series event. Perhaps the most egregious of which, in terms of fan voting, comes from, obviously, Wolverine is a much more popular character than Lobo, always has been. So naturally, they match these two characters up, knowing that Wolverine is much more popular than Lobo. However, Lobo is purported to be, I would say, fairly in the top 15 to 20 of most powerful DC characters, can't be killed, has the strength of Superman... You know, has a giant space motorcycle and a hook and whatnot, and he is generally bad news.
Mm.
Wolverine has claws and can scratch people and can heal. So I love Wolverine. He's my favorite Marvel character. But there's no way that you could ever justify, from a logic standpoint, Wolverine beating Lobo in a fight. So what do the creators of this series do in their infinite wisdom? Russell, I believe you can attest that... They don't actually show us anything happening.
Nope. Off-panel death. And you're just left to, fill in the blanks, as you will. And
to make it worse, Wolverine, like, they go behind a bar, and there's just, like, cartoonish little effects coming from behind the bar, and then Wolverine gets up and smokes as if he's just had sex with Lobo.
This is what I was thinking, too. I was just like, he didn't actually kill Lobo. He might have sodomized him. And maybe that's what happened.
I think more egregious was the fact that Lobo was probably a bottom for Wolverine. I didn't see that playing out.
And actually, if you go back and get it with hindsight, the new 52 version of Lobo might actually like a little bit of that bottom action from Wolverine, if you know what I'm talking about.
He's a little bit versatile. Okay.
He's got a little metrosexual thing going on. A little sleek back hair, a little trendy vest,
He did enjoy a recent slap fest with Hawkman, and he wound up winning that fight though. Handily, and that's a pun. Whenever you read it, you'll get it.
What were some of the other kind of
I've got one
lackluster fights in the DC versus Marvel series?
They were all lackluster. Like, I've got the list in front of me. Should I give it a rundown real quick?
Let Tim go first, and then
okay.
Well, this is undoubtedly on your list, but Storm versus Wonder Woman. Okay, so Wonder Woman is the premier DCU, basically all of comics superheroine, right? Like,
arguably the top female character, like in terms of
I think not even arguably, like without a doubt, like there's nothing Marvel has offered up that's even close to matching Wonder Woman. They don't really have like a top female, you know, superhero. They just don't. Like DC does, Marvel doesn't. And the closest they could come was, I guess, Storm, which, all right, fair enough, but she actually beats Wonder Woman, which
because of the fan vote.
Because the X-Men were so popular, and because
probably John Byrne was writing Wonder Woman at the time, and that was a pretty marginal series. So this is very much a product of the times. You know, it's kind of a time capsule. And I mean,
and how
let's look at the fact that who is Wolverine's opponent in DC versus Marvel? It's Lobo. How many people even know who the fuck Lobo is? You know what I mean?
In the mainstream, not many.
Right. I mean, in 1996, absolutely, it made sense. But nowadays, it's like, what? Who's this guy? Of course Wolverine's going to beat him. But in the context...
Of course, Superboy, the leather jacket wearing... No, not Superboy. I'm sorry. Robin and Jubilee have to have a love affair because they're the team.
Robin, because they're the two sidekicks. Yeah, they're the two heteronormative sidekicks. Yeah. So that's going to happen. Yeah, well... I'm getting away from my point, but Wonder Woman and Storm have this fight. Storm's the best that Marvel can offer up as far as their signature female superhero, which, you know, I'm not going to really down that. I mean, honestly, yes, Storm probably is their highest profile female superhero at the time, but she beats Wonder Woman again because of fan votes. And how does she beat her? She hits her with lightning a couple times. That's it. She's done. You know, Wonder Woman is just this mythological character who, you know, has fought gods and goddesses, and you know, that's all it takes.
And can give Superman a run for his money on any given day.
Can give Superman a run for his money. Well, you know, Storm, who's like the second tier leader of the X-Men on a good day.
And a great character in her own right, but just not the power level of Wonder
Woman. Exactly, exactly. And that's what was so wrong-headed about this thing, is that you took characters who were very worthy in their own right, matched them up against each other, and it was like, it inspired such indignation because it came down to fan votes, and it was like, who's better than the other? And it's like, well, it's not really a question of who's better. It's just, you know, this character has pros and cons, and you can't really make it just a straightforward slugfest. And that's what it came down to. But anyway, that's the one that stands out in my mind as the most bullshit, you know, convoluted, manufactured, like, victory in Marvel's favor.
I just want to give you the rundown. The way this worked, I did a little bit of... I was excited about this topic because, you know, the Amalgam Universe has been such a reference that we've made in so many of our podcasts. The way this actually worked is there were 11 fights that comprised this series. Only five of them were decided by fan voting. The reasoning for that is the writers knew that if, let's say, all five of the fan votes went to DC, they could still balance it out, having six that were not fan votes to make it appear close, so that it would only be decided by one battle, right?
Which, by the way, wouldn't have happened at that time because Marvel had so many more popular characters.
Or if Marvel had won all five fan votes, they could have balanced it out with the other six. Here are the results of this unofficial. This is the ones that the writers decided. Here we go. Aquaman defeats Namor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Elektra defeats Catwoman.
Okay.
The Flash defeats Quicksilver.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Robin defeats Jubilee.
if you can call it that.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Yeah.
Like melting into each other's arms or something. Strange.
The Go Silver ahead. Surfer defeats Kyle Rayner Green Lantern.
Okay, I guess, yeah.
Here's the one that doesn't make sense to me at all. Spider-Man defeats Superboy.
Yeah.
I can tell you why that one happened.
Okay.
And it was the Ben Reilly Superman.
Yep, that's why it happened, because Superboy was a clone of Superman, and Peter Parker was a clone of Peter Parker, Ben Reilly. Because this is when Ben Reilly was established as the real Spider-Man, and Peter Parker was the clone all along. So he's the clone, Superboy is the clone of Superman. It makes sense to match them up, so...
In the squished together universe, when I remember this panel very vividly, when they were introducing Ben Reilly to this universe, he's coming to work at the Daily Planet, and he's introducing himself as Ben Reilly to begin with, but then he just decides, you know what? Nah, just call me Peter Parker, because that makes total sense.
That's really funny because, well, it gets into more minutia of the Clone Saga, but the idea was, you know, Ben Reilly was going to be set up as the real Spider-Man, right? And they're going to retire Peter Parker allow Peter Parker to retire and have his quiet family life with Mary Jane, in much the same way that Chris Claremont was going to retire Cyclops with Madeline Pryor, and they're going to have a kid together. So, you know, that was the idea, was, you know, Peter Parker is going to go away. It's the Spider-Man we've known and loved for so long, but his time has passed. We want a swinging single Spider-Man again, so here's Ben Reilly. So we thought he was the clone, but actually he's been proven to be the real Peter Parker, but he only thought he was the clone.
And now he can't be Peter Parker because Peter Parker has been Peter Parker for so long.
Because Peter Parker has been Peter Parker for so long, but if Peter Parker goes away for long enough and the fans will accept Ben Reilly, the swinging single Spider-Man, eventually he can, you know, reassert himself as Peter Parker. And that was actually the idea, was at some point he was going to assume the identity of Peter Parker. And for all intents and purposes, he was going to be Peter Parker, Spider-Man, once again, but unmarried.
And you mentioned the swinging single. That just speaks to a larger problem with Marvel. They think that the editorial there seems to think that the only way Spider-Man works is outside of a relationship, unmarried. And I think that, like, I've always found the Spider-Man-Mary Jane marriage to be very fascinating because you don't see many instances of superheroes being married and trying to make it actually work, which I know that there aren't, you know.
Wait, I thought DC was the only one who had something against marriage.
Oh, don't even get me started on that one, you know, one more day bullshit.
I thought Marvel was the only one who had something against marriage.
But
it turns out we all hate it.
We all hate marriages.
I will not make a comment for sake of my own life. Anyway, back to Marvel versus DC. I mentioned the six battles that were decided by the writers. The five fan vote battles were Thor versus Captain Marvel, in which Thor defeated Captain Marvel. Wolverine defeating Lobo.
Captain Marvel? Wait, well, hold on. Who was Captain Marvel at the time? I don't remember.
No, this was Billy Batson.
Billy Batson. Old Shazam.
He was
Shazam, yeah.
Thor versus Captain... Okay.
Thor versus Captain Marvel. Wolverine versus Lobo. Storm versus Wonder Woman. You know, we've already said, you know, Thor, Wolverine, and Storm were the three Marvel victories. And then Batman topping Captain America and Superman topping the Hulk.
Topping? Okay, never mind.
Well, whatever.
They didn't go behind a bar in that fight, though, so we don't know.
No.
We don't know exactly what happened.
It was way more candle, champagne, and cream and berries.
But exactly. I think the point of all of this is that, like, in our heads, or for me as a kid, like, you have to understand, I didn't read very many comics at all around that time frame. I wasn't really into it yet. But when I saw this on the shelf, I picked it up because as a kid, like, the idea of Superman and the Hulk fighting each other sounded like the coolest freaking thing that I had ever heard of.
Mm-hmm. I thought of that itself as being an entire book's worth of a fight scene.
And then when you read it, you get this bizarre story about, like, the red cosmic being and his brother, the blue cosmic being, like, being in conflict with one another, and these fight scenes that are happening within that don't really have any context at all.
And this
don't
new really, character that you're supposed to like, but you really have no reason to care about one way or the
other.
Yeah,
and don't really have endings. And then, like, even though Marvel technically won more fights than DC, the whole thing is declared a tie, and the brothers, the cosmic brothers, have to settle this in their own way, which leads to...
Hang on. Before you... I'm gonna let you finish, but I just want to say before we get to the aftermath of Marvel versus DC, apparently, and this has come out after the fact, neither company was allowed to publicize, like, who the winner was. Like, they weren't supposed to brag, yes, you know, that we won, whoever, yes, it was. Well, guess what? Marvel ran a whole bunch of house ads in 1996, yep, after the thing, yep, finished, and they say they didn't, but they did, because I have the goddamn comics. I can post the images from them, and it says, Marvel versus DC, the fans voted, Marvel won!
I remember this distinctly. I remember it because, as I mentioned, I was still reading Spider-Man at the time, hanging on with Ben Reilly and all that, and I distinctly, yeah, remember those ads saying, we won!
They were
won.
Not supposed to do it. And it was like, oh, well, you know, it only appeared in a handful of issues, and it was just like, you know, they're $20.99 comics, and no. These ran in a whole bunch of comics, like all the X-books at the time. I think a whole bunch of, like, Fantastic Four comics, yeah, in the $20.99 imprint, whatever was left of that, but it was pretty hard to miss, you know.
After, DC probably would have done the same thing, so.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure they would have. But apparently it was a big violation of their contractual terms of, you know, you can't publicize who the winner of this is. There's not going to be any winner. Even though we've put it to fan vote, well, Marvel said, we won. And I remember it was like all their characters running down like the border of the page. And it was like, holy shit, and, you know, really? And it only ran for this 1 month and then had to get pulled because they got in trouble. But they did it. So.
And then this, of course, not to steal Nick's thunder, but this led into the Amalgam Universe, which combined all of our favorite Marvel and DC characters into hybrid characters, some of which were interesting. Bruce Wayne, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., I think, was kind of cool, or what some of the other ones, and some of which were just absolutely bizarre, like Spider-Boy and other things like that were very strange characters. And at this point, the vast majority of the comic-buying audience in the United States did the equivalent of the Seinfeld walk-away-from-the-theater gif.
I'm out.
Yeah, and then we got the...
otherwise known as, like, the Nick watching Transformers 2 gif, in which I actually walked out of the theater.
That's it. Stood up. The end. Goodbye.
That was actually at the moment in which... And I know we're getting way off topic, but in Transformers 2, there's a moment where the Decepticons have done something Decepticon-y, and they're doing a fake newscast, and somebody says, this is the worst terrorist attack on American soil since 9/11, and I went, well, and just walked out of the theater.
Give me my hat, sir.
Yeah. I didn't realize it at the time, but they might have actually been making a point about the movie itself.
Now, let's wrap up the 90s, gentlemen, with a pretty neat and tidy bow with that. Very quickly.
Oh, okay.
Favorite event of the 90s, least favorite event of the 90s. Let me start with you this time, Russell. Favorite and least favorite events of the 90s.
Favorite event of the 90s. I'm going to have to wind up going with Nightfall. Just because of, you know, how, like I had mentioned in the previous cast, that it was easily the most focused. It felt like, you know, it had the most emotional payoff for the main character whenever he finally comes back at the end. And I mean, Death of Superman was running a close second with that, but with Nightfall being that complete, like, Bruce Wayne goes away, Bruce Wayne is, you know, gone from the picture, we have this, like, really horrible version of Batman running around, and then, you know, the triumphant return of the real Batman. That was the event that just it really did it for me as far as the 90s go.
And also one of the, in my opinion, one of the best examples of introducing a new villain that is actually a threat to the hero.
Sure, and it was done very well in that respect. I mean, Return of Superman really did a great job of establishing Cyborg Superman as a great villain. I loved him for that, but like I said, Nightfall just felt more focused and was a little bit better written. But, I mean, they run neck and neck for the most part. And absolute worst, Onslaught.
Oh, thank God.
That was one of the single worst things I have ever seen in comics. And you know what? If you want to point to an example of why Marvel went bankrupt, that wasn't the direct cause of it, but it was that nail in the coffin.
I'll go ahead and go next, and I'll start with my least favorite, which is Onslaught, because that's such a good segue. Because we've written in our hard traveling fanboys secret origins pieces, which you can find on placetobenation.com, ladies and gentlemen. That is the story that finally cut my ties to comics for years, and it wasn't. It's
Jesus,
almost
really
yes, and it's not even.
I mean, I know because I've read all of these. I'm just
right. Certainly, you've read them all on, I believe, placetobenation.com.
On placetobenation.com exclusively.
What's that site right. again?
I believe that's www.
PlaceToBeNation.com.
Can you spell that?
.com. But this was the book that made me walk away from comics finally, because it's not even that I necessarily think that it was necessarily the worst story of all time or anything like that. It's that it was so symptomatic of what was going on in comics at the time. All of these false promises and just lame twists and heroes gone bad and all this other, it was like every like cliche 90s event thing rolled into one story, and it seemingly never ended. It had that cheesy Franklin Richards pocket universe conclusion, and just you know, I haven't had the heart to go back and read it in recent years to see how it holds up, but I hated just about everything about it. I hated the idea of the villain. I hated the characterizations in it. I hated the stupid relaunches, or not the relaunches themselves, but the fact that they wiped everyone out and teased that everyone was dead, and then, oh, sorry, they're actually still alive. Just kidding.
Heroes Reborn.
Yeah, and all that stuff. So I hate that event so much. And I never even read Heroes Reborn because I literally stopped buying comics after that. After the Clone Saga burned me, after Superman burned me with Electric Blue Superman and all that stuff, and after, you know, Batman was still pretty decent at the time, but I just wasn't interested anymore. And Emerald Twilight, after all these events had kind of burned me as a fan, that was
Cataclysm
the nail in my coffin.
Was going on in Batman at the time, and that lit. Batman was one event after another, but I feel like the overall quality on Batman was still pretty good, even though it was in constant event mode, so I can see how you could sour on that.
Well, I mean, Denny O'Neil was the editor, and the books were still good for Batman, but I think after Nightfall, I kind of got to the point where I was satisfied. Like, I felt like, as a kid, I was like, you know what, that kind of... Okay, that's the Batman story. I'm kind of wrapped up now. I understand it. Even though I've gone back in recent years and read, you know, Cataclysm, Contagion.
It's
no
funny.
Man was really good.
It's funny because they actually did the sensible thing, which was to end it. You know, Nightfall had a concrete, concise conclusion, and then they did Prodigal, which is a pretty good story, but it was like, okay, we're done. We're done with the story we were telling. Now here's Prodigal, but a lot of people are like, okay. And then they did Troika, which put Bruce Wayne back in, you know, the suit. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, that's a pretty big deal. And it was like, well, where do we go from here? We've been doing events for so long that that's what people are accustomed to.
And then it became the disaster run. That you have
they want to read Bruce Wayne as Batman, but at the same time, they're kind of finished with all these crossovers, so what do we do? And it was just that, yeah, like you said, that disaster porn era where it was, what was it, Contagion with Ra's al Ghul and
Legacy,
Cataclysm and Legacy and Bruce Wayne Murderer and
Fugitive, No Man's Land,
Fugitive and No Man's
Land. No Man's Land's pretty good. Like,
oh no, all that stuff,
all that stuff,
good.
Yeah, all
every
that
one
stuff
of those events
good.
Is good. Yeah, it's good comics.
Yep.
But like, but I'll go ahead and say my favorite event of the '90s for me would be Death of Superman. For nostalgic reasons, as well as being a great, and Nightfall for me would be a very close number two. But Death and Return of Superman, that whole epic, I guess, is kind of to me event comics done right. And Nick, your favorite and least favorite of the '90s, real quick.
Favorite easily Nightfall. I mean, the '90s were a time where even Batman, who was probably the darkest, most anti-hero hero of the DC universe, even he was not quite, I'll use the term, spawn enough for the '90s, to be fair.
Yeah.
And that really did a great job of revitalizing my favorite character in all of comics and reminding people why, for all, no matter what happens over the years, Bruce Wayne is now and will always be the true Batman, no matter what happens. Not to steal Tim's thunder, but I'm sure he's going to get to Infinity Gauntlet in a little bit. That's a '90s event that's quite arguably like one of Marvel's crowning jewels in terms of the legacy it leaves and what we're about to see on the big screen. So that's probably my favorite from the Marvel side of the house. You know, least favorite? The ones I've read, honestly, I've never read Onslaught. Never read the Clone Saga in its entirety. If I was going to go least favorite, I guess Armageddon 2001, but that's more of a half-hearted, you know.
Because again, you can't even really summarize how bad the ending to that was.
Yeah, but you know, like I said, it's one of those things where the beginning's actually pretty good, and the ending kind of pisses you off. And because I haven't read a whole lot of
Oh, what
books,
about Bloodlines?
Is that really
the annual
fair?
Crossover?
Yeah, is that really fair to call it an event book though? Because it never had its own
it's
title.
Fair. Yeah,
it was more of a branding across some annuals that you could really take or leave, and it wasn't really didn't really tell a cohesive story. Yeah, it's bad to be honest. Yeah, every issue of it that I read was bad, but I didn't feel like it really tied together. And for me, it doesn't really. When I think of event books, I wouldn't really think of Bloodlines as that. So I mean, yeah, terrible, but I'd probably still give the nod to Armageddon 2001 just because of all the wasted potential I felt like it had.
Tim, real quick, favorite and least favorite of the '90s.
Okay, favorite, it's the 800-pound gorilla in the room that has been mentioned, Age of Apocalypse. This was the big X-Men event that was their first alternate universe foray. Not that they hadn't done different timelines and different takes on these characters before, but Age of Apocalypse was the first time they said, okay, we're going to lay all our cards on the table. We're going to look at the implications of what if. What if events played out differently and we got a completely different history of these characters, of this universe, of this entire conceit of mutants in the Marvel Universe. And, you know, I'm the type of person, I think that the idea of mutants as people with superpowers works a whole lot better when it's isolated, when you don't have other superheroes, metahumans, whatever you want to call them, people who have gained powers through radiation or different accidents or whatever, where it's just humans and altered humans, let's call them mutants. You know, the central conceit behind the X-Men just works a whole lot better when it's not confused with a whole lot of white noise behind that. And I think that the Age of Apocalypse took that to its ultimate potential, where it said, you know, mutants are the dominant species on the planet, and we're going to capitalize on that. What are the implications of that if, you know, someone who was sufficiently powerful decided, you know what, everyone else is going to be beneath my heel, basically.
Even if those powers are kind of vaguely defined.
Even if those powers are kind of vaguely defined, yeah. And at the end of the day, ordinary humans are like nothing to me. They're just, you know, part of the, you know, machine, essentially. And they are going to be subservient to me. And it was like kind of exemplified all of the themes and everything that the X-Men were fighting for up to that point, and highlighted why mutants are different and why this idea of evolution and, you know, humanity and what that meant, you know, whether this was going to be, this was going to fundamentally change who you are as a person or not. It drew that really stark contrast between the two extremes. And, yeah, I mean, they did explore in kind of a related limited series of what the other supposed Marvel heroes were up to at the time, but it was very much off to the side. This was totally its own thing, and it was allowed to play out, you know, that natural progression of what if, you know, at some point in history there was this great spike in humanity and evolution and mutant powers, and how would that progress? And the way it played out was, of course, this, you know, dystopian future, for lack of a better term. It was the present. But the cool thing about Age of Apocalypse was it was an alternate timeline, but it was joined in progress. It was presented as if it had this history.
And was the status quo.
It was the status quo, exactly. So it would make reference to events that had come before that had never been published in comics that you actually read, but it was just like, we're going to roll with it. This is what happened. You know, we have confidence in the story that we're telling and your ability to follow along and get on board with this. You know, it wasn't like they had to connect all the dots or they were just doing things at random. No, it was very methodical and very much plotted out and planned by the various creators. You know, this was kind of the brainchild of Bob Harris, who was the editor on the X titles at the time, Scott Lobdell, who we've talked fondly and not so fondly of in podcast past. Yeah, Fabian Nishiasia, so gotta get that. Gotta
Hi,
get
Fabian.
That references. Fabian, yeah.
And the Gold Gotham Ship Monster, oddly enough.
Oddly enough, yeah, made an appearance in a series called Factor X now. but no, it came at a time when the titles were kind of at a creative peak in the 90s. Like I said, you had Scott Lobdell on the title that I believe became Astonishing X-Men, which was not the Astonishing X-Men that people think of today with Joss Whedon, but it was just a four-issue limited series. Scott Lobdell, Joe Madureira, that was...
Sorry.
Yeah. Uh-huh. One iteration.
That name just... brings up images
it brought it all back, right? It brought it all back.
No, it that name forever will be connected with me for Ultimates 3 and Ultimatum. And so it induces this deep like pain deep down in my gut that just makes me groan every time I hear it. Talk about an art style that I hate. Joe Madureira might be like my least favorite artist in the history of comics.
There was a time when Joe Madureira was like the guy who reinvented the X-Men for the 90s, because for so long, the X-Men followed in the tradition of Jim Lee, and he kind of set the new standard. He was the new house style, and
I'm sorry.
Like Andy Kubert came into the picture, and he did his own thing, but it was pretty much still that Jim Lee style until Joe Matarera came along, which was like 94, 95. And he had that kind of anime, kind of manga influence, which Jim Lee had as well, and kind of goes unacknowledged, but
not
he just took
to
it to another
that,
level.
Yeah, I was going to say, not to that degree.
Right. It was a totally different animal. And he took it to another level. And he was pretty popular on those books, and I can't say anything bad about Joe Matarera's contributions to the X titles. His latter day work, kind of neither here nor there, but at the time it was like, whoa, this is something we've never seen before. So, you know, be that as it may, you know, Scott Lobdell, Joe Matarera, on the other kind of flagship title, just X-Men, that turned into Amazing X-Men, which was Fabian Nicieza, Andy Kubert, kind of doing the same type of stories within that vein. Excalibur turned into Excalibur, but was spelled differently. I don't even know how to articulate this on an audio. But Excalibur was spelled, you know, Excalibur phonetically, and then in Age of Apocalypse it was X hyphen Calibur with God, I'm embarrassing myself. With Warren Ellis, who had just recently started writing the title, and like, I don't know who did the art, like Ken Lashley or somebody. Not Bobby Lashley, but Ken Lashley. X-Factor became...
No.
We all love you, Bobby. X-Factor became Factor X with John Francis Moore, who was an extremely underrated writer from the late 90s, early 2000s. He did X-Force, like, after Fabian Nicieza, I think. Really, like, he did a lot of really layered storytelling with a lot of subplots, really intelligent writer who has been forgotten in years since, but totally underrated guy, John Francis Moore, and Steve Epting on art. Steve Epting, you might remember from Captain America, the run, the most recent run with Ed Brubaker. Steve Epting did the art on that. Pretty different storyteller at the time, but very talented. What else? Wolverine became Weapon X, still written by Larry Hama. Awesome Wolverine writer at the time. And Adam Kubert on art before he kind of developed his own signature style. Gambit in the Externals.
Yes, replaced, I was about to bring that one up.
Replaced X-Force, right? So yep. There's Fabian Nicieza again, the art by, I think, Tony Daniel?
Yeah.
And also Salvador LaRocca, very early art by him. You know, not the greatest series and during this crossover event, but it is what it is. And I mean, it's just
fanboy at the time. I enjoyed the hell out of it.
There you go. Like, yeah, I mean, Gambit was a hot character at the time, and this was a really good spotlight for him. Oh, not to forget Generation X, which had just started up. It only had 4 issues under its belt when Age of Apocalypse started.
And one canceled. Hell of a television movie.
One, oh, shit. Wow. Yeah. Talk about trying to derail the podcast. If we get started on the Generation X TV movie. But I can't remember if that had debuted before or after Age of Apocalypse, but the fact of it was, it only had 4 issues before it was canceled and restarted as Generation Next during AOA. Again,
it's not the same as John Byrne's Generation Next or
the Pepsi commercial.
Next Men, there we go. Yes.
Next Men, right. So, yeah, definitely not the same. It was Scott Lobdell, still Chris Boschlow on art. May not be saying that correctly, but... again, kind of a highlight artistically of that creative team, even though it was not the mainstream Marvel universe. So this is really a snapshot of Marvel and the X-Books in the 90s with these creative teams and what and the types of stories that were being told. Like, it was a very much self-contained event. Like I said, it was joined in progress. It pretended like it had this history that you weren't familiar with, but was there all the same. It had the confidence to go ahead and say, this is something that is joined in progress, and you need to just get on board with that or you're going to be left out. You know, it wasn't like anybody was coming in thinking, well, I don't know as much as the next person. Everyone was on the same page when this thing started. And, you know, I've kind of left out what the premise was behind this. And
well, I'm gonna have to interrupt you real quick because Russell is running low on time. We'll get back to Age of Apocalypse, or we'll get to your least favorite as well in a minute. But
yeah, absolutely.
Russell, I want to give you the floor for a minute to talk a little bit about the 2000s and the modern era, which I would say from 2000 up. Okay. Tell me one or two of your favorite events of the modern era, and maybe one or two of your least favorite events of the modern era.
Oh wow! As you know, there are a lot of things that I've actually loved about the modern era, and I know that I mean, it's got its low points too. But I'll start with like my DC high points. I'll pick two. In chronological order being Infinite Crisis and
yes.
And its subsequent sequel being 52. So I kind of feel like they're of the same event. The one is married to the other, or mm-hmm. at least they might as well be a single event, because, I mean, if you're going to read Infinite Crisis, do yourself the favor of reading 52 right after it.
Absolutely. Totally agree.
It's they're the same event. Just keep going.
Sadly, and, no 120-pound omnibus exists with both events in one.
It does not, but...
But you can get both separate events in two omnibi and read them together. It's a great experience.
And you might as well do that. It looks great on your shelf, too.
Yep.
The other big event was the one that I consider the absolute best of the modern era, because it culminated after a few years of build up, we finally get to Blackest Night, and I mean, Geoff Johns had started this back with Green Lantern Rebirth, and had, you know, built from there to Sinestro Corps War, which was, you know, this other really I want to call it an event, in that it sort of was, but it was more self contained into Green Lantern than anything else. But Blackest Night truly was an event. It
expanded the scope of Sinestro Corps War to the entire DC Universe, which Sinestro Corps War was great too, but like you said, self-contained. Blackest Night was something that touched every corner.
But even Sinestro Corps War felt so big at times. I mean, if you remember, it had Superboy Prime running around, you know, doing crazy things. It had Superman in there. Sinestro Corps War, in my opinion, easily could have been a company-wide crossover rather
than... I'm glad it wasn't, though. I'm glad that it was self-contained. But Blackest Night kind of took that concept and did its own thing in a very, very interesting way. Now, Russell, I think you were actually buying all the tie-ins at that time, and I got to read them through you, and it was just a really cool event.
I bought everything that had the Blackest Night banner on it, as far as like the comics that were running at the time, and... I can safely say that this was that one time when I did that I didn't regret spending all that money.
I was about to say it's probably the only recent example I can think of where all the tie-ins felt, even if they weren't important per se to the main event, they felt like integral to your reading experience. They felt like they enhanced the overall narrative.
And they really did, but the ones that surprised me most were the ones that I expected to like the least, and that would have been the three-part JSA tie-in.
Yep.
It was just a little mini, and that was a fantastic story. But then there was a two-parter, Teen Titans and then the Outsiders that crossed over into one another, had this really emotional moment with a Black Lantern Terra coming back from the dead, and her and Beast Boy having this moment where she's, you know, talking to him like she doesn't understand how she's been brought back. She's you know, scared of what she, you know, is playing, that she's scared of what she's become, but all it was to get an emotional response out of Beast Boy so she could eat his heart.
And that was literally the only... I never grew up reading the classic New Teen Titans in the 80s, but I had seen the cartoon and I'd read a few appearances from them. But that's, even without the context of having read those stories, that was such an emotional scene. That entire issue was just, from top to bottom, just so great, with a character that I had never really encountered much before in Beast Boy.
And to speak to another tie-in that I truly thought was going to be the low point of Blackest Night, but wound up being one of my absolute standouts, was the Catwoman one-shot. Mm-hmm. When they brought her her title back, it had been canceled like a few years back, and they decided to bring the title back from the dead, if as you will. And she's being stalked by a newly Black Lanterned Black Mask, the man that she had killed.
Who she had killed at the end of the Ed Brubaker launched Catwoman.
Yep. She had murdered him, and he was back to, you know, chase her through. I want to say it was through Arkham Asylum, and
yeah.
It was one of the trippiest issues in all of the Blackest Night crossover, and it had no bearing on the event itself. It was just one of those things where, you know, they said, "Hey, write a Catwoman tie into this," and it worked perfectly. I mean, just a fantastic event. And the thing is that Final Crisis was running around the same time. It had started a year before, and it was also plagued by delay, so it was kind of running into the same time that Blackest Night was being published. And what was funny was DC realized how flat Final Crisis had landed, but how big a hit Blackest Night was turning into. So then all of a sudden you start seeing all the ads and the promotional materials shifting away from Final Crisis and being all about Blackest Night.
But of course that's just a result of the populace not really being prepared to accept the genius of Grant Morrison in Final Crisis.
Sure, that's exactly what it was. I mean, there's no other logical explanation. I mean, it couldn't
none.
I mean, the idea that it was just a complete turd from
shit
the beginning
ton of a story,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, that's lies, slander. Grant Morrison's a genius. But the thing with Blackest Night was that for the readers, it was just this incredibly emotional ride from beginning to end. And it finally brought all those pieces and all those this big puzzle that Jeff Johns had been laying out, the tapestry finally revealed. It all looked fantastic, and it was everything we hoped it would be. I mean, that was the fear going into Jeff Johns's, you know, long form run, was that once he finally culminated all this, that it was not going to be as awesome as the setup. But the payoff was bigger and better than everything that had come before it.
It really did culminate.
It did.
And then it
coalesced and was beautiful.
And then the fear was, how can he possibly continue the run after it? I mean, Blackest Night really could have tied such a beautiful bow on the whole thing. The fear was, how does he continue it past that? And even he went longer and wound up adding what I feel now is an essential element to his Green Lantern mythos in the ultimate redemption.
The redemption of Sinestro.
The redemption of Sinestro.
Which began in Blackest Night.
Yep, absolutely.
I did that. I'm glad that he stuck around, because I think I remember reading in interviews where Jeff Johns said that he had originally thought that just that Blackest Night could have been the end. He could have stopped there, but then he had all these ideas going forward of what he wanted to do, continuing onward with all these characters, and then, you know, Brightest Day was born of that. And, you know, mileage will vary on that one. Though I will say that I'm one of those that enjoys it for the most part, and only think it has a few low points here and there, Hawk World being the main low point of that.
It depends
story.
On what you're looking for. If you're looking for earth-shattering importance, that's not really it. But if you're looking for some interesting stories told with the, what was it, 8 characters who were resurrected at the end of Blackest Night, I think it's a pretty cool, you know...
And by the way, some pretty good Green Lantern stuff going on.
It's a pretty cool inspection of those characters as who they are and what they mean now that they're resurrected in this universe that's largely unfamiliar to them.
And it also gave us the return of Geoff Johns to The Flash, with him writing Barry Allen instead of Wally West, and the introduction of most people to Francis Manapal's art on The Flash, which that was kind of the opening salvo of his what would eventually be his epic run on that title in the New 52.
So what would be your top kind of event for Marvel over that same time frame, top one or two events?
There's a couple. House of M kind of got me to read Marvel again and like really take it seriously. And, of course, I had to go back and get Avengers Disassembled before that since it was the segue. Both of those might as well be the same event as well. Good stuff there. And I'm with Nick on Civil War. I actually really enjoyed that. But I want to add one more to this as a guy who would ultimately become one of my favorite comics writers was introduced to me through another event that should be like two. It's two events that should be one. It was Planet Hulk and World War Hulk, written by the incredibly talented Greg Pak, and that I had never really read a Hulk story before. It had never really occurred to me that I could enjoy the character as much as I would in those two stories, but. I mean, talk about like really great build. I mean, as a three-act story, man, it builds. It really made Hulk into this relatable character, while still keeping him as a rage-filled monster. but you start to see that, you know, as destructive as Hulk seemed on his own world, there were far worse things out there, and. In the right setting, he could actually be a really wonderful hero and somebody that you could find yourself just really rooting for.
Sorry.
When he comes back to Earth to exact his revenge on the Illuminati for shooting him off into space, there were some really great moments in that. So, I'm gonna go with World War Hulk as being one of my my top from Marvel for the 2000s.
What about your 2000s and modern era least favorite event?
I've already said it for DC Comics. It was the bottom of the barrel is Final Crisis.
No.
But I'll throw one more in there. Our World's at War.
yeah, I remember that one.
Which is meh. Maw.
It was that I remember seeing the trade of that, and it was so thick that I thought, man, this must be awesome. And I read about maybe 40 pages of it, and I was like, God, this is boring. And I put it back on the shelf at Books a Million.
It goes from boring to confusing, and then you find out if you do a little research later on that's not even the whole thing.
Oh my God.
When they collected it, they didn't collect all of the story. They just packaged in as much of the Superman and JLA stuff as they could, but they left out some key chapters that were written as tie-in books.
Yeah.
So you wind up with this mess of a story that, whenever it was running, didn't really make anybody happy, but then when it was collected, it just pissed people off. So Our World's at War, right on up there with one of the greatest turds of the 2000s.
Is it fair to say that Jeff Loeb might be the biggest hit or miss writer of all time? Because when he hits, he knocks it out of the fucking park. And when he misses in such a gloriously, spectacularly terrible fashion that it's
the only
hard
thing
to do
I really remember being good about Our Worlds at War was President Lex was during that time, and I always thought that was a cool character move for Lex. But I also remember there were some bizarre character deaths during that story too. I think
it seemed like Our Worlds at War was like primarily a Superman centric story because it was President Luthor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was.
When they solicited the trades for it, the trades were actually packaged as Superman, Our Worlds at War.
Yeah, but then you look at the trade, and they would have had to publish like 170,000 Superman comics to comprise these trades.
Yeah, I was going to say, it crossed over into like everything,
and the thing is,
did stuff like, wasn't there like 1,000 Doomsdays or something?
Yes. That was the beginning of Doomsday, like, working for Darkseid or what have you.
Yep. Yeah, and, like, Dan DiDio writing Superboy and really, like, awful, like, the end of a lot of really celebrated runs on a lot of different characters.
Is that when they killed off Aquaman as well?
I think so.
I think that was him dying in that. Yeah.
It's either when they killed him or brought him back. I don't remember.
Well, he was brought back in Brightest Day, so that.
Yeah, I think they killed him in that, and then they had a brief run with Kurt Busiek where he had another Aquaman, and I can't.
That was a different guy. Yeah.
The thing is, Our World's at War and Final Crisis kind of represent the two types of going off the rails with a DC event. Our World's at War kept trying to come up with ways to correct itself and get on track to what they thought fans wanted to read, but could never get there because they never could get any of their ideas to really coalesce, so it just winds up being this big, muddled, boring, confusing mess. Final Crisis is that going off the rails, and then once you realize you've gone off the rails, you stoke the fire hotter so you can go off faster and see if you can salvage it by making a really big explosion at the end. And oh yeah, kill Batman.
Yeah.
That's the ticket.
But not kill him, Russell. You have to displace him in time so that we get caveman Batman, pirate Batman, Puritan Batman,
Old West Batman.
Old West Batman, and whatever retarded hippie, psychedelic new wave concepts Grant Morrison can try and fit into his douchey, pretentious Batman run.
And it kept going. But the thing that bothered me most about the whole Quantum Leap starring Bruce Wayne was he's basically becoming his ancestors throughout time, and it's implied that he is impregnating I'm like, well, this is I'm not really sure how Bruce Wayne is supposed to feel about this.
A time traveling man still has needs.
Needs
that can only be met by his great-great-great-great-great-grandmother.
Exactly.
Oh God. That's the quintessential bad for DC in the 2000s.
Especially since he's Bruce freaking Wayne. It's been established that he can pretty much step out on the street, look at a woman, snap his fingers, and go, "Hey, you, sex," and that it pretty much happens. Like,
is his
great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother really the best he could do?
That's pretty much what led to Damien, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
But I know he was drugged.
God.
But I got to get to the Marvel side of bottom of the barrel. So let's get here.
Do you need any hints? Because
no, because I know exactly where I'm going. Dark Reign. Nope. But there is one worse. Siege.
Ouch.
Siege just kept, that just kept going, didn't it?
It sure did.
We were talking about establishing of Midgard over a city in Oklahoma. Siege is where you can lay blame for that one.
And honestly, just approaching it from a Thor standpoint, I don't mind the idea of that as much as I do, I guess, the way it's been handled. If that makes sense. Like, to me, the idea of Asgard relocating over Earth, it provides a more direct tie for the other Asgardian characters to Midgard. They necessarily don't feel in the same way that Thor does, and it kind of forces everybody to kind of re-examine this this realm that they've always kind of taken for granted or viewed as the lesser or the peon realm, And only having read bits and pieces of Siege, I can't really...
I think it's...
Plus, again, that whole element of Asgard over Oklahoma was introduced during the J. Michael Straczynski run on Thor, which, while abbreviated, is still one of my favorite modern takes on the character. So the concept I can't knock as much as I can the execution of what they did with it in the years since.
The Siege also represents one of the worst ways to execute an event that I have ever seen. because they had the single event book, the Siege book, and then umpteen billion tie-ins to it, but instead of them being tie-ins that you could take or leave and just read the main book, nope, you had to read Siege, and then from one issue to the next, I remember there was a fight that was being built up in one issue of Siege between Thor and I forget who it was, but it was like, all right, we're going to get this fight.
Hercules, I think.
Yeah, it might have been, but it was going to be this big fight that was going to happen between those two characters. And, I mean, we've been building this for a while. Next issue of Siege comes out. Fight happened in a different book. You got to go read this book for what all happened here. And then you start to realize that you can't read just the event book itself. You have to go get Avengers. You have to be reading Thor. You have to be reading New Avengers. You have to be reading Iron Man. You have to be reading Dark Avengers. And this is why Marvel has the real problem of event fatigue, because whenever they do an event, that seems to be the direction they want to go. Now, they've kind of taken a breather from that with their most recent events, but there for a while, that was the formula they were going with, because I guess they, you know, they were essentially forcing people to buy books that they might have otherwise skipped. And that is always going to be my biggest problem with any event, be it DC or Marvel. If you do that to the fans and force them to buy books that they might not otherwise have wanted to be into, then it's cheap tactics, and it doesn't always pay off, because I mean, sometimes you'll buy those tie-ins and they'll be completely flat. Like, you'll be like, oh, I had to buy this to see what happened here, but then the rest of the issue completely sucked. Couldn't I have just read that in the event?
I'm sure we'll get into this to a minute, but I want to tell my story of my experience with Civil War and post-Civil War tie-ins whenever we reach the appropriate time.
Sure, but I know Russell's running short on time, but I want to ask you one last question, Russell.
Okay.
What, in your opinion, makes a good event book? What are the ingredients of a good event?
A good event book needs to be the culmination of something. It needs to be like you've been building towards some big – I use Blackest Night as a prime example, because Jeff Johns had been building towards this big event for a long time. He had laid all this groundwork that fans had been – you know, they're on board with him. They're following him all the way in, and – he gave them every bit of payoff that they wanted to see. But on top of that, your event books are going to attract casual readers too. That's, you know, kind of their purpose, is to bring people to the comic shop or to get them to try out a book because they say, oh, wow, this big thing is happening here. It affects the entire line. I might as well see what all this is about. And I could honestly say that I could probably hand you a copy of Blackest Night Zero, let you read that, and it would essentially give you just about all you would need to know in order to jump into the book and just go forward. And to me, that's another thing that makes for a good event, is making it accessible to those people who might not have been following you up to this point. This is your chance to really get them interested in what you're doing. And I feel like Jeff Johns is a master of this. From Infinite Crisis to 52 to Blackest Night,
Trinity War
to
even for, solo titles, man. Like,
yeah, and it, even his, yeah, he gets it. He gets how to do an event. If you let him quarterback your event, it's guaranteed to be at the very least interesting, and at best the moment that will change your comics reading life. And that's, he's done it again, I feel like, with Forever Evil.
Yeah.
Not quite up to the level of, say, to Infinite Crisis, but damn close. And that's how you do an event. That you build it up. Yes, you have tie-ins. But, and the tie-ins that were required reading, like the Justice League tie-ins to Forever Evil, they felt like they moved things. They gave you really good information, and they were entertaining in and of themselves. The Cyborg and the Metal Man issues alone are just pure gold. And that's how you do it. You let one guy architect the whole thing and have that cohesive vision, make it accessible, give off and give a good solid payoff to what you've been building to, and I guarantee you have a successful event.
And there you have it. Russell, thank you so much for that. I agree with everything you just said. And again, we lost Todd earlier in the conversation. He had to go at the end of the first broadcast. And Russell, I understand you're short on time as well, but we really thank you for being on the giant size Hard Traveling Fanboys. We hope you will join us again in the future, and certainly for our normal monthly comic podcast at placetobenation.com. Any parting words, my friend?
Well, as always, guys, it's been fun. I mean, we could talk comics for hours and hours and hours, and I hope that our
and we next... might still.
and I'm sure it's about to keep going in my absence, but it would be awesome, you know, if we could get around to some of these other topics in depth. I'm sure that we could have an entire podcast dedicated to the awesomeness that is Geoff Johns and his entire Green Lantern run.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think our next big podcast needs to be the great Green Lantern debate, because honestly, I always knew that you, myself, and Greg were huge Green Lantern fans, but after hearing Tim's take on Green Lantern, it seems like that really makes for a great discussion, and I would love to have Todd in, because Todd, you know, having the wealth of experience, you know, the old hand, if you will. I feel like
the seasoned
veteran. I feel like a Green Lantern debate is in our near future.
I agree. I think it's going to be a good time, and I'm looking forward to getting to the next one. I've had a great time with everybody, and to parting words to the audience, don't forget to check out the rest of the great columns, Hard Traveling Fanboys, of course. You don't want to miss that every single week.
At placetobenation.com.
At placetobenation.com. You don't want to miss my columns, New Hotness, Seller's Points, and a new wide column that I feel like everybody's going to be contributing to soon, called Five Reasons Two.
At placetobenation.com.
We're going to get all these plugs in before this is over. But anyway, guys,
yeah.
it's been fun, so I will see you guys next time.
All right, guys. And with that, we're going to take a quick break, and when we get to the flip side, we'll get to the 2000s for Tim and Nick.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly from Ring of Honor Wrestling. Make sure you check out The Kevin Kelly Show each and every week, placetobenation.com. We'll be talking about wrestling in the past and wrestling today, plus be talking about all kinds of sports and pop culture, whatever's on your mind, too. We'll answer your questions each and every week. The Kevin Kelly Show, right here, placetobenation.com.
Let me know you in the house.
This is the king of old school, Steve Corino, and you've heard all the rumors, and it's true. The Steve Corino Show is here. We talk about wrestling, we talk about baseball, movies, television, anything you want to talk about. New guest every week. That's right, the Steve Corino Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at placetobenation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on placetobenation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast exclusively at placetobenation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and... Shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans are wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans are wrestling off.
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for a show at Breakdown Matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Pop. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week, you can join Marcus Vanderberg, Big Nasty Alfred Kunawa, and myself on the Kings of Sport podcast, available exclusively on placetobenation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, this is Ben Morse from Marvel.com as well as the Brad and Chad Show, and I've got a new podcast. Well, I'm part of a new podcast, Place to Be Nation's Main Event, hosted by Scott Criscolo every other week. It's a roundtable discussion with myself, Andrew Reich, Steve Willey, Jordan Duncan, and an assortment of special guests as we talk wrestling today, the big questions, and our feelings. Please, please, please check this podcast out, because if the ratings go down, I know I'm the first head on the chopping block for Justin Rosero. See you guys every other week on Place to Be Nation's Main Event.
I'm Scott Criscolo, and your new home for sports is Place to Be Nation's Extra Point. Join me and the doctor, Giorgio Bellino, for your sports hookup, whether it's NFL, Major League Baseball, NBA, colleges, or the Cowboys MMA Blitz.
Forget about it. Plus, join me for my prescription where I will solve all the world's sports problems with my own brand of medicine.
That's Place to Be Nation's Extra Point here on PlaceToBeNation.com.
In Rhode Island and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers. In a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Bonehead's also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective, and we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Don't forget to check out our fantastic podcasts as well, including the voice of Ring of Honor, Kevin Kelly, exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, ProWrestlingOnly.com, Scott Keith's blog at RSPWFAQ.net, and PileDriverWrestling.net.
Hey there, Nation. This show's going pretty long, so what we're going to do here is break this into two parts for you. If you're on PlaceToBeNation.com, you can go ahead and click the link right in this very post. If you're listening on iTunes, part two will start right now.